Welcome to The Lowdown, KMXT's show dedicated to giving you the up-to-date information we have available on the COVID-19 outbreak and how it's impacting life on Kodiak Island. The Lowdown will focus on facts as provided to us by local and state officials. During the show, we give you access to these local experts who have information on COVID-19 and recommendations related to it. If you have a question for our guests, please email it to lowdown@kmxt.org or call KMXT at 486-3181.
And good morning and welcome to another special edition of The Lowdown. We've been running some episodes of The Lowdown this week as schools are reopening and we've had some society is kind of reopening, our community is reopening a little bit, and so we have doctors on, we have the school district on earlier, we had the college on for some Talk of the Rock, and then we had a special Crab Fest Talk of the Rock yesterday. As Crab Fest is going to go virtual next week, and so today, for today's Lowdown, we brought in members of the Emergency Operations Center, and I can see them all on the screen, and I'll have them introduce themselves in just a second, but if you have, as Pam said, yes, if you have questions, give us a call, questions for the EOC, give us a call at 486-3181, or email us at lowdown@kmxt.org, and we will try to get your questions on the air. I think we almost always get everybody's questions on the air. So I would like to welcome members of the Kodiak Emergency Operations Center, and that's actually kind of my first question, but we'll introduce each other first. So I see a lot of tiny people on the screen. So can you go around and introduce who all is with us today?
Elsa, do you want to start?
So I'm Elsa Dehart from Public Health, but I'm not really an official part of the EOC. I am a liaison for them.
And I'm Mike Twenge. I'm the Emergency Services Director for the EOC.
Jim Mulliken. I'm the Deputy Director of the EOC and the Emergency Services Coordinator.
Good morning. I'm Megan Christensen. I'm one of the Public Information Officers for the Kodiak Emergency Operations Center.
All right. Well, good morning and welcome Elsa, Mike, Jim, and Megan. I guess my first question is, what is the official name, or what are you doing business as, I suppose? Is it the Emergency Services Organization, Emergency Operations Center, Emergency Services Center? I'm hearing EOC, ESC. What is it?
So we, like Elsa just mentioned, we are a part of the Emergency Operations Center. Elsa is a late liaison for us in this situation with the COVID-19 as a health coordinator for us. But the Emergency Services Council, the ESC, is our policymaking board. The ESC is made up of federal, state, and local agencies. That way we cover all gamuts. We have the borough mayor, the city mayor. We have the borough manager and the city manager, like myself. We have Coast Guard base and Coast Guard air station commanders. We have the Alaska State Troopers. So that is the Emergency Services Council. But the EOC, which is the ones that are responding directly to the pandemic, are made up of borough and city staff. And then we've got a couple liaisons. We're working with the school district, public health, Coast Guard there as well.
KPD.
And KPD is assisting in public information as well. So it's a big network of people working together for the common cause.
And, I will say that everyone that... our listeners who call in with questions and come by with questions, every single one of them remark on how well of a job we feel that our local Emergency Operations Center is doing. Mike and Jim, you guys, you've done a fantastic job, is what we hear. So these questions are more about curiosity. They're not, you know, they're not critical questions, because I think the vast majority of Kodiak residents are really proud of you and the work that and the work that you've done and the work that you've done in overtime over the past 6 months. How would you describe, how well are you working together with all these various facets and members of the organization?
I'd say we're a really tight-knit group. We've been working together now for months and months on this. Typically, the community doesn't really have much interaction with the EOC because our normal natural disasters are tsunami warnings and such, and they last, you know, maybe 6 to 24 hours at the most. And we, you know, people don't realize who's setting off the sirens and who's responding to that as much. But in this case, we've got all agencies. The ESC board meets every Thursday morning. The EOC, we meet right now. We were meeting 5 days a week, but right now we're meeting Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. With Tuesday and Thursday, some of us are actually active in the EOC. Our PIO is 5 days a week, and of course, we're always on call over the weekend. So it takes a lot of dedication, and it takes a great deal of commitment from all staff to hold together for this long. Like you said, working a little bit of our overtime here. We've got our day jobs, and we've got this side job, I guess it is, but it's our duty. And it's set out in city and borough code how the two agencies are established. So it's a long-standing group, and it's well organized, and I'd say we're working very well together. And I appreciate the comments from the community that are acknowledging some of the work we're doing.
You mentioned the tsunami, and you know, a few weeks ago we had the late night tsunami alarm. I wonder if we can do a little debriefing. What worked, what didn't work, and what did we learn about an emergency during another, or right in the middle of another kind of emergency with the pandemic? So what worked, what didn't, and what did we learn?
I'll start out, and then I'll let Jim chime in on that as well. We kind of all sat around and acknowledged the fact that we jumped right into our roles. We switched from COVID to tsunami very easily. We've been working together for so many days now. We all knew our roles in the situation, and it was a pretty seamless transition for us. As far as the community did very well. We were under a tsunami threat. At one point, we were announced by the state EOC that we were going to see a wave coming, and it didn't materialize, fortunately. But that's where the public has to be understanding this. We get the warning, same as anybody else can get on their National Weather Service site, but we have a direct line of contact with the state. And that's where we get some inside information or some more detailed information. But other than the short alarm, I think it went very well. Jim?
The community responded very well. People evacuated. The one caveat on that is there was a lot of people who were evacuating who did not need to evacuate. And with the new inundation maps that are available both on the city emergency preparedness page and the Kodiak Island Borough website, people need to go back and verify whether their house is in an inundation area or not. If they're not in an inundation area, they don't need to evacuate. And the reason I bring that up is you have a lot of vehicles on the road, a lot of people moving to get to higher ground. And if you don't need to leave your home, it just keeps that extra rig or, you know, pedestrians off the road and reduces the amount of traffic. So that would be a really good takeaway for people to go to the websites, verify whether they're in the inundation or not. If they are, absolutely evacuate. If they're not in the inundation zone, they do not need to evacuate, because the zones are based off of worst case scenarios set up by the Tsunami Warning Center, the scientists that do all this stuff, and that's who's furnished it to us. Outside of that, things worked very well. The some issues that come up in previous information flow from the Tsunami Warning Center has been corrected. We got our warnings in ample time. We got our alarm set off, and we're moving forward to that. Also, one more thing, if people have not seen them, there's a big Connex sitting down next to the fire station in downtown, have our brand new tsunami siren poles on it. Our new system is on its way and hopefully will be installed before the end of the fall. There will be no downtime in the service. The old system will remain active. They're basically going to do one alarm at a time, but we're going to have a brand new, fully operational tsunami warning system up before winter sets in. So really big to do with that, because we're getting rid of our old 1940 vintage sirens to our latest and greatest one. So it's really a big thing for us.
Is the siren sound going to be different?
They are going to be slightly different. The tones themselves will be slightly different. The actual, how do you want to say it? The warble or whatever, you know, the actual up and down or whatnot is going to be the same. It's just going to be more electronic than being that the big air horn kind of things that we have now. But we will hold training for the community. Once they get in, we'll activate them. We can actually talk over them. We can send messages over in multiple languages so that we can reach all of our language groups on the road system. So it's actually really a great upgrade for both the city and also into the borough on their stuff on the road system as well.
We're going to do some training on that.
Yes, absolutely. And one more thing I could say again on the evacuation. We do not recommend people go up Pillar Mountain. In the wintertime, the gate is closed because of the dangers on the road. Even during the summertime, the road is open. However, if people get into trouble up there, we cannot get to them because of traffic jams and stuff of that nature. So we highly recommend people stay on the lower system. Get up Mill Bay Road. Once you're above the lights by Coonfield, you're well above the inundation zone. You can find a place somewhere along the road to pull to the side, and you're in an absolute safe area. We do not recommend people go up the mountain.
And this was, go ahead.
Let's talk briefly about the school district, how they are involved in that too. They have the school district opened up immediately for the evacuation center. And then the parking lots were full, and parking lots are a great spot to hang out until you find out the all clear has happened. But like Jim said, there's no services up Pillar Mountain. If there's an emergency, it's difficult to get up there and with all the traffic that's been occurring. You're better off staying in town in a safe area. And the shelters, the evacuation centers can turn into a shelter if needed.
And the final piece that's in this is the all clear is given by the Emergency Operations Center. We still have things that we have to check. In this case here, we felt the quake here in Kodiak. So one of our jobs before we issued the all clear, okay, we might be clear of the wave, but we have to verify that there are no landslides, that the roads are all open and people can move from their evacuation areas back into their homes, no down power lines, stuff of that nature. So when the all clear comes through, we issue the local authorities across the state are who issue the all clear. The Tsunami Warning Center simply tells us whether or not the tsunami threat itself has passed. Then the local authorities then pass off the all clear and let people return to their homes.
Yes, thank you for saying that, because that was one of my questions. This was my, I think, second or third tsunami alarm working with the radio station or doing stuff with the radio station. And every time there's the debate on social media that the National Weather Service has canceled the tsunami watch, but we're at the station trying to tell people exactly that we have to wait for the local all clear just for those reasons. So thank you for clarifying that. And one more question about tsunami. We had a question come in. As part of these new tsunami sirens, is Passagshack going to get a tsunami siren?
I believe that's part of the plan is to get something out there. I have to actually pull up the borough side of the plan and see exactly where they're putting them. I know that's a glaring issue out there, and they're working on rectifying that.
Communication to that siren is the difficult piece of this. you have to be able to activate that siren, and it's not within line of sight.
All right. Okay. So let's turn to the COVID-19 questions that have come in. One is we are still getting questions about clarifying airport procedures, departures and arrivals. If you are departing from Kodiak to somewhere in state, you only need to test if you're going to a village or to a place that has some kind of restrictions or requirements that you need a negative test. Is that correct? Because I'm leaving on a plane on Monday to take my daughter to Fairbanks to college. She needs a test, but anyway, I was wondering if you could kind of walk through the process of departures and then expectations for arrivals, people coming either from in-state or from out-of-state.
Your summary is correct. We are following the state of Alaska mandates and guidelines regarding travel, which, you know, recently changed. So it's sometimes confusing to keep up on those. But what we do, we recommend that people go to the state's website at covid19.alaska.gov/travelers and read through the information and then pay particular attention to those pieces that pertain to them. As for you traveling with your daughter to Fairbanks, there's no requirements for testing or quarantine. The focus is mostly on interstate and international travelers coming here. And then, as you also referenced, the smaller communities, the villages on our island have the ability to make their own rules. And we are trying to be very respectful of that. And I believe that was the main reason that CANA set up a testing tent out at the airport, is to be able to offer testing before people move on to those villages.
You mentioned that, you know, communities will have different rules, and I think that's a large part of some confusion is just that every community is different, and even how communities report numbers, you know, new cases and data like that, it also seems to vary from community to community. I think just yesterday, you know, the Alaska DHSS dashboard finally reported 10 of the Alitac cases that we reported. Oh, gosh, what was it, Elsa? You know, it seems like 10 days ago, 10 or 11 days ago. How are you working with that? As a group, trying to juggle different reporting expectations and, you know, different mandates and rules for the communities in our borough.
What we try to do on our dashboard for Kodiak is get the information to our citizens as quickly as possible for cases that occur here on Kodiak. That way they can get an understanding of the true threats and whatnot that are happening in our community. The numbers do get reported to the state, and then they have their reporting matrix that covers the whole state, and interacting with the federal stuff or whatnot. Our dashboard, the information that we pass, we try to keep it as clean as possible so it only deals with what happens here. Yeah. So if we say it's a positive case here on Kodiak. If we say it's an active case, it's an active case here on Kodiak. We don't, once, if they're not in Kodiak, they're not on our island and part or on our archipelago, we don't follow through with them. That's the state and whatever other agencies they get passed off to. That helps our people be able to look at that and say, okay, well, how many people are active right now on the island? You can look at our dashboard, our numbers, and that'll tell you that number. So it's not including numbers of people in our Anchorage or people are in Seattle that are Kodiak residents. We don't count them unless they're here on the island itself.
Anything to add to that?
Well, we have counted sometimes because of the confusion with the state. If it's a Kodiak resident that's like doing medical in Anchorage and was positive, I think that's on our list. But we made it really clear to the community because people see it come up on the dash, you know, on the state thing. There's a case in Kodiak and Everybody worries. And that way we're consistent there. But that's only, I think of all of our cases, that's only been one that we had somebody that was in Anchorage and tested positive in Anchorage and stayed there. But otherwise, yeah, we want to keep our numbers here. And a lot of those people are non-residents, but they were here and they isolated here. So
that's something you'll see on, if you look at the state website, you know, our numbers are pretty high. When you look at the numbers on the state website, their numbers don't match our higher numbers. And the reason is that if a person is pop positive in Kodiak and they are a Florida resident, they're actually counted in Florida by the federal system. So that's where a lot of this confusion comes from, is how the feds are trying to track all of this. That's why when we were trying to figure out how do we get information flowed out to our community, we wanted to stay with something that was pretty simple and straightforward. And that's why we were trying to maintain it as these are only the people that we deal with here on the island itself.
Yeah, there can also be a delay between the time that we report or we announce here in Kodiak that we've received report of a positive case. But that paperwork sometimes takes a little more time to get to the state and show up on their dashboard.
Absolutely.
And the reason they keep fussing with it is so that people are only reported once to the CDC. So a lot of times you'll see even ours, we had to do that, and other people's, it's like, oh, we found out that really this person should have been counted as a Florida resident, I mean, officially. So, you know, those kinds of things. So you will see adjustments, but that's a good thing that they're fixing the data once they get more information. Because the most important thing, like Jim says, is we want people to know immediately that there's a case on Kodiak so we can get it isolated. And so far, knock on wood, we've been pretty successful.
Speaking of isolation and quarantining, we had a question come in where someone has found out that a cannery is using a trailer in their neighborhood as a quarantine house. So the question is, whose responsibility is it to monitor the quarantine of cannery workers, you know, workers like, you know, non-residents that come in to work in the industry? And to what extent do residents of that neighborhood have a right to know that somebody is being quarantined or placed in isolation?
So I don't think that anybody's been using for isolation per se, but so the difference is quarantine. When somebody comes to the island, just like if you came here because you have been traveling and you need to stay at home. And I mean, you're quarantining as you're staying at home. You're not going out into public here, but you can walk out in your yard. I mean, it's a little bit more flexible. I mean, yeah, and because you haven't been sick yet, you are just waiting to see if you have become infected. So that doesn't mean that somebody's infectious or dangerous or anything necessarily if they're quarantined. Isolation is different. That's somebody who has been identified as a positive case, and they really have to stay isolated and away from everybody and not even wanting to share bathrooms or anything. And not, unless they have a severe medical emergency, not really leaving their homes at all. So that's a little bit of the difference between the two. You wouldn't really need to worry about, I mean, lots and lots of people, hopefully here in the island, are quarantining, who fly in from other places and spend their 14 days staying at home. So there's a little bit of a difference there.
Mention how that we're responsible, we're active in the isolation side.
So yeah, and public health monitors every day anybody who is sick, except for, well, the military, like the Coast Guard is very strict, and they tend to monitor their own people and watch it. But we call them every day and make sure that, you know, they are doing what they need to. And the EOC has been great too in helping, you know, find places and help people to quarantine that are here from elsewhere or anything that needs to be done. So transporting people if they do need medical attention, that kind of thing.
The other piece of this is come back to what is the threat to the public. And the message from the beginning of this still holds absolute merit. If you say 6 feet or more apart, wash your hands, wear a mask, that kind of thing, when you cannot maintain your social distancing, we will stop this virus. So if someone's in their home or in, like in this case here, the scenario was they're in a trailer. If you don't go near the trailer, you can't get it. If they're behind the closed doors, you can't get it. So, you know, whether it's the family down the street, your family, something like this, it comes back to that continual message that we're putting out with our signage, our banners, everything. If you remember social distancing, washing your hands, wear a mask if you can't social distance, again, stay home if you're sick. We'll stop this virus. The biggest issue is the virus needs something to jump to. And when it's moving through a community, people are not following through with those basic rules. It's not going to be a mystical, magical, boom, it's done. The only way we're going to stop it is if we as a community come together, acknowledge that when we go to Safeway, maintain our distancing, a car to park kind of thing, wear your mask, wash your hands. That's what's really going to stop this.
And I just want to follow up on this. So is it the, just so this listener's question is answered, is it the cannery's responsibility to make sure that anybody who is quarantined stays quarantined? Because I think part of the concern is that they've seen people come in and out of this trailer, or people in the quarantine trailer have been outside walking around. So is it the cannery's responsibility to make sure that those protocols are followed through on their workers?
Well, you know, I don't know that there's any policing that's going to be absolute. I mean, a lot of this is on the honor system, and we do hope that people follow the quarantine rules. Can somebody come out in their yard and get a breath of air? Absolutely. You know, walk around. The idea is that they're not out in public. You know, if people are going into the house and somebody does land up getting sick there, then those people will be contacts and be quarantined. So hopefully that they're very careful. If somebody comes into the house, they're not coming near any of the people. You maybe they go in and drop something off and leave, or on the porch. You know, there, I don't think, you know, at this point in our world, in our country, there is nobody who's going to necessarily stand by and, you know, watch everybody every minute they're in quarantine.
So, Jared, those processors that you're talking about, the seafood processors, they're essential service. So they have submitted a mitigation plan, and it may be part of their plan. But we're meeting with them at 10 o'clock this morning. So we'll be able to ask that question of them just to clarify that. But like Jim said and Elsa said, they are if they're quarantining, that's different than isolating. And either one, if they're sequestered into one area, that's the right thing to do.
And I will say that the processors have been really responsible about making sure that they follow the rules. And there are groups, like some of the essential workers will quarantine a group together, you know, but that just means that if one in that group gets sick, then the whole group gets quarantined longer, but that they do have that option, just like a family would. You know, your family may want to quarantine together, but then if somebody gets sick, then it makes it a longer quarantine, but you know, you have that option to not totally be locked in a room.
And and if we can just take a couple minutes and talk about Alitac, speaking of the seafood processing industry, any updates there? And I think there's still some concern about how that even happened, how, you know, nearly 40 people who, even though they tested positive here, there's a lot of, you know, just, I'm sure you've heard this too, discussion in the public about, well, you know, they got sick, or they actually contracted the virus off island somewhere, and then were transported here and then actually tested here. So they're counted here, but we still get like about a question or two every day about there's just this kind of fog, I guess, around the whole thing, and a lot of concern about Akiak, which is about 10 miles away from Alitac. So So can we talk about, you know, what's going on with some, you know, the direct charters? Are they bypassing some of the safety gates here at the airport? How did this get through, I guess, is kind of the question.
So, you know, I don't think that anybody knows exactly how it got through. I mean, there is a lot of talk. OBI has really worked hard and they're trying to figure out, you know, kind of how this happened too. But it appears that when they brought in some workers from NACNEC, which was kind of a hot spot, that somebody who may have tested negative before they left even landed up getting sick here. And that's kind of how it spread through. They were very careful though. They took those people who had been quarantined and tested, you know, in NACNEC to Alitech in a charter that came straight through. I think it landed in Akiak's runway, but never interacted with the community, went straight to Alitech and were there. And then again, when they flew their people out, they flew them directly from Alitech to Anchorage. So they did not go through the airports or anything like that. And then, they had the whole process where the pilot was, you know, was fit tested and wore their masks, and then they fogged and defogged the planes when they came and went, and they were all charters. So they've been very careful, and really after that burst, it's quieted down there. And the people that have been left, there were a couple people that were essential, like people who knew how to turn the ammonia off in the cannery, or those kind of really important people that kind of stayed, that they were monitoring down there. And I believe they're done now with their isolation. And so I think it's pretty safe to say at this point they're doing really well down there.
Can we get some reactions to some of the letters that other communities have sent the governor, Ketchikan, Bethel, I think Homer, about mitigation mandates, what's going on with the Anchorage mandates? I'm sure you're kind of keeping a very close eye on what other communities are asking of their citizens, but also asking of the governor's administration.
Well, as far as the mayor's mandates in Anchorage, Mayor Berkowitz, you know, as far as closing down dining to indoor dining again and bars, et cetera, I can understand the frustration with the businesses. They just came through a difficult time earlier when the community was hunkered down and they want to be open. But as Jim was saying, and we all are saying, there's only really one way to stop this or reduce the spread of virus, and that is avoid contact. And so indoor dining, you know, you're eating without a mask on, and bars are the same way because it's hand to mouth. And it's just a way to mitigate this. And it's very difficult to tell the community to go back and maybe risk your business. That's why it's so important here in Kodiak for us all to work together as one positive group to say, we're gonna battle on this, and we're gonna keep our schools open. We're gonna keep our businesses open so that we can survive this economy. That's our goal here, and the community is doing very well, and we're proud of it. We don't have a case physically this week, I guess.
Not a new one. We have one that's finishing up.
Yeah,
that's it on the island right now.
And so that's really good, and it's all about containing those isolated cases. If we do have a couple outbreaks, you know, we know right away because of testing. And I'm not sure, Elsa, you know the number of tests we've conducted on island as of today.
You know, we're over 7,000, about 7,200.
Wow. Yeah, so a lot of people are doing routine testing, and that is one way to identify right away because of the symptoms are not always visible. And We're tracking what the other communities are doing, absolutely. We're trying to stay ahead of that so we don't have to be hunkering down and shutting down our businesses again. A lot of our festivities over the summer have been either postponed or canceled, and that is to avoid the spread. We've got an event coming up next weekend, I understand, out at the fairgrounds. I hope everyone is very cautious out there and we don't see another spike like we had in Alitac, because as we all know, close contact is the way to spread this virus. And if those people that attend that concert next weekend ignore some of those rules, we may be into the same situation as Anchorage, where we're having to close down because we have to get control. So hopefully we don't have to go there, but it's very difficult for our whole economy. A lot of people aren't working. A lot of businesses are slow. People are reluctant to go out and do what they did before COVID-19. And right now, that's just something we're going to have to work on and mitigate as best we can.
Has the ESC been working with, you know, the chamber on Crabfest next week? Have you worked with the folks at the fairgrounds about this concert next weekend, or, you know, I think Kira's got their races going on. Have they been working with you on this, or is there really kind of like no expectation really that they need to approve or discuss these kinds of mitigation things with you?
Well, fortunately, everyone is paying good attention, and we've got the safety section at the EOC that reviews mitigation plans. And the concert next week did submit a mitigation plan. It was accepted. The conditions that they're going to have out there meet some social distancing and such. And we just hope that they're able to maintain that plan that they submitted. Of course, we're working with the chamber on several different topics, but the community has been very well about submitting a plan. They just want to see that what they're doing is going to be positive and correct, and we appreciate that. I don't know the exact number of plans we've seen, Jim. We're about 135 or something now.
We're up there, absolutely.
Wow. Yeah.
And also with... I know you've obviously been working with the school district. What about some of the other schools opening up, Kodiak Christian School? And it looks like St. Mary's isn't going to operate this week, but the Christian School, Kodiak College, I have to ask, you know, Kodiak College, have you been working with them also?
Yes, they've put in a request for, I think, 450 face masks through the EOC, which we distributed this week. Helping to keep them safe out there.
This is the college?
Correct.
Okay. Have you worked with the Christian school?
Jim, have we?
I got to go back and look at the list. I can't answer that question right off the bat. I have to look at our list and see who we've all covered.
Sure. With summer, you know, winding down, schools about to be back in session, people may be spending more time indoors, right? As it gets a little colder outside and a little darker. What are you doing now, or what are you expecting as everybody starts to move indoors? What are we expecting with those kind of shifting dynamics?
Well, as far as the EOC, we're already planning for that. There's potential for an outbreak there. Fortunately, we're at the green risk level, which is the lowest level. So we don't have as great of a threat that you would think if we were in the yellow or the red section. But, you know, places like Anchorage and Fairbanks are high level, red level, and their chances for spread in the school district when they do open is going to be much greater. But we're looking ahead. That's what we do. We plan and get prepared. So we're looking ahead to see, you know, there's going to be more people coming in from the different fishing fleets. We've got hunters coming in. There's also a lot of chances for the virus to come back to the island. And if so, that could spread within the community. And then the school district would be a concern because, you know, there's, you know, multiple groups of kids and staff all in one area. So we're looking ahead and we're being prepared for that. But Hopefully we can avoid that, right? Just like the tsunami that never comes.
Do you find that people, residents, Kodiak residents, are complying with you know, businesses' mandates that they have for, you know, for their restaurants and for their stores? Are we doing a pretty good job of complying with the rules that individual businesses have set up?
I'd say overall, yes. I know there are some businesses that aren't enforcing the masks, but the ones that are doing it for the community. They all recognize the need to stay open as a business, and if they can do their part to mitigate the risk here, that's what they're doing. So I encourage all businesses and those that submitted a mitigation plan. The EOC put out another storefront decal that asked the public to wear a mask when in that business, and you'll look for that as well. But there are still some businesses that don't take it quite as seriously as others, and I wish they would hear my message right now to join in on this.
This might be a question that you can't answer, but we've had it come in, so I'll go ahead and ask it anyway. So this kind of has to do with the Coast Guard, which you had mentioned before, and kind of generally, do you know how has it been for new families coming in and this kind of experience moving to a new place in the middle of a pandemic and various lockdowns? We are hearing rumors that the Coast Guard isn't allowing new arrivals, are allowing Coasties in town to restaurants and bars. There's been no official mandate that we can find, but we're hearing that they're really trying to quarantine especially the new families and new arrivals, the new Coasties, for a very long period of time throughout pretty much the whole summer.
Well, we can answer that question very easily. We are working very closely with the Coast Guard. We've got the base and the air station commanders on our ESC, so every Thursday morning we hear about what they're doing, and it's all part of us working together. But anyone here in the group today could answer that question.
And they have been, and because they are military, they have that capability to really say to somebody, this is what you can do and what you can't. But they are being very cautious and quarantining their people when they come in and making sure. And I have heard that they have kind of limited community access to some of their members, but that's something that they do have the option to do. The other option they have on the other side of that is, boy, when they've had a case, they are on it right away and make sure everything is isolated and that there's very little risk of that spread, which is a real positive for them. They've worked really hard to try and keep their people safe.
They've been phenomenal partners during this response, and they take extraordinary steps to help protect the community, but also to meet their primary mission, which is to help our fishermen when they're in trouble out there. So they take extraordinary steps to ensure that they can meet their mission to help our people when they call and need help, that they can get that helicopter out there, that they can get that ship out there to render assistance. So they do go through these processes to ensure that anybody from the base, once they get up here, can be released into the community, so to speak, and not propagate this disease.
And Jim has talked before about, you know, even his crew, if somebody, you know, if they got some infection in their EMS crew, you know, that totally hurts the entire community's
Absolutely.
Response because they don't have anybody else to fill in there like a big city may. So that's a big difference with a small town.
And this might be a question for Pat Branson, if she were here, but can you talk about any special precautions for seniors? I know when this first started, there was really a lockdown, hunkered down to protect our senior population. How has that changed at all over the past 6 months? Where are we now with these precautions for seniors?
Well, I think it's the same situation today as it was early. You know, the senior center is giving delivery pickup for lunches. I believe they're still closed to indoor activities. Is that true? I think that's true. Yeah.
Yeah. It's still the disease is still very much a threat to our elders, especially with underlying health conditions and stuff of that nature. So it's just as bad today as it was when it first started. Yes, we've learned more about the disease, but it's also something that we still are very concerned with. So information flow is out there for them. Any of our elders can contact the senior center and they'll get information flow out to them where they can get meals, so forth and so on to meet their needs. We still also have our volunteer group that helps deliver meals and stuff of that nature to assist people that can't get out of their homes, that kind of thing. So, and also if they need somebody to talk to, it's also services of that nature available to help our people that have to stay locked up or have to stay quarantined. You know, we got to choose our words here because it's
absolutely,
we don't want to totally isolate themselves because that's a bad thing. Mm-hmm. We want a community. We are a community. So there still needs to be interaction, that kind of thing. So there are services out there available for them that they can get a hold of.
Do they still need, I remember there was a push for volunteers early on. Do they still need volunteers for what you were talking about?
Last we've heard that they have, there's a whole system that people can volunteer to. They were really full of volunteers. So the community's response to this has been absolutely positive. For the majority of the part across the board, you know, there's so many partners in this to make this a success. It's not just the Emergency Operations Center or not just the Emergency Services Council. We have partners from the fishing industry, the food industry, Safeway, Walmart, Providence, KCHC, Canna. There's just so many, and I'm remiss in not listing them all equally because everybody is a part of this response. And we're doing as well as we are because we, the citizens and groups in Kodiak, are doing it right. And we're doing it together. That is the biggest message that if anything comes out of this is how well we are doing. It's not just one person or one small group. If we, that the community doesn't come together and do this right, we're hurting ourselves. And right now we're doing pretty well.
Well, we have about 2 minutes left, so I'll kind of end with this question. What are we waiting for to happen to declare all of this over, to disband whatever the term is, the EOC? Are we waiting for particular metrics? Are we waiting for the governor or Dr. Zink, the president? What are we waiting for to happen?
I mean, on the medical side, I think we're waiting for an effective vaccine, you know, so that we can get to the place where through a vaccine and through whatever we can achieve that, where we're not seeing the spread like we are now, reduce that risk. As far as they would know, the emergency orders, all those kinds of things, I don't know how that works.
Well, sadly, pandemics last for a long time.
They do.
And it's going to be difficult globally to control this. But eventually that day will come. You know, we're shocked that some of us were shocked that we're still in it today, but then, you know, learning more and more about the virus and how it's working, we've decided that we're in for a long haul here. And, you know, what we really need to do, what we're all preaching and what Jim has been very clear about saying this morning is we can work together to keep our community at the green level. And, that'll be the best thing we can do here on the island. Fortunately, we are on an island and our travel is going to be limited. And, you know, with the ferry system rescheduling for the winter months, our risk is going to go down a little bit and we're going to do our best to keep it down.
All right. Well, I want to thank my guests from the Emergency Services Council. We got Elsa DeHart, Mike Twenge, Jim Mulliken, and Megan Christensen. Thank you so much for spending a little bit of your Friday morning with us, and thank you so much for your answers, and thank you for all the hard work that you are doing to keep our community in the green.
Well, thank you, Jared, for helping us get the message out.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right. I think we'll toss it back over to Pam for the Island Messenger.